So, I imagine you've heard enough about suffering. But it's not over yet. But suffering, the topic of suffering in Buddhism, or the attention to it, is meant to be a path to happiness. So there's some lines in a poem by Rumi where he says something like, if you dive into the refreshing cool water, you'll come out in the sizzling fire. If you dive into the fire, you'll come out in the cool water. So be a little careful, you know, what you chase after. There's a teaching about suffering that is like with the analogy of going to the plains of Africa, savannas of Africa, to go photographer going to take pictures of the wildlife. And apparently that if you go just roaming around the savanna to take pictures of all the wildlife, you have to do a lot of roaming. But if you sit quietly by the watering hole, all the animals are supposed to come to the watering hole, so you sit and wait. So if you sit by your suffering, or if you're ready to pay attention to it, everything you need to know will come. You don't have to get a PhD in Buddhist studies, I can guarantee you. Everything will come just from the, you know, the watering hole of suffering. It's quite profound to pay attention to it, but we don't want to pay attention to it to suffer better. That's not the whole point. And the idea that the word noble is added to the first noble truth has many kind of connotations, but one I think is a certain nobility or dignity or uprightness, strength that goes into this encounter with our challenges. And it's certainly, by using the word noble, it's certainly not suggesting that, you know, no good, lousy, crummy, unfortunate drag of suffering, you know, like just all dismissive and bad and just like, you know, just get me out of here. It has a different connotation. So this idea of nobility in relationship to it, I think it's fascinating. One way of seeing people get tripped up a little bit around the word truth. One English Buddhist professor has argued that in the ancient language, satya, the word translated as truth, is better understood and more properly understood as reality. So it's the four realities. So the reality of suffering. Another way of looking upon these four noble truths is that they're frameworks. They're four frameworks by which to study our lives. So they're not exactly, you don't necessarily take them as the truth, philosophical truths, but it's one way to sit by the watering hole. You look at your life through these four areas and you get a lot of important information. You get the kind of information that may be helpful to lead you to freedom from suffering. If you have another framework for your suffering, maybe it's not as productive or as efficient to help you kind of get to the bottom of it. And one of the frameworks that the Buddha tried to avoid for this purpose was a framework of me, myself, and mine, the framework of self. And certainly issues of self and identity are important ones for us and how we live our lives. But for the Buddha, at least, to really get to the heart of the matter, you want to use this Four Noble Truth framework. That's much more productive. It gets kind of like, I think the idea is it gets more quickly to the heart of the issue, whereas issues of self get complicated very quickly. And there's other, you know, frameworks that people can use. There can be, you could use numerology, you know, and figure out what day of the month it is and what year it is and the time of day that you should, you know, really address your suffering, you know, and get it all lined up. And if it's happens to be March 14th. It's a special day coming up. And so there's a lot of important things that can happen on March 14th. My son is in high school. He's going to be, he won a pie that he's going to have on March 14th. And he won it. It's pretty important. But it's not a coincidence that it's a pie, because he got an A on his math test. And March 14th is Pi Day, 3.14, and so forth. So, you know, you can do the numerology, and you'll get to your suffering, you know, eventually, after the pie. So, you know, anyways, this idea of the Four Noble Truths is a framework to help us. But this evening, I'd like to offer a different framework, and at least try it. I've never thought about this before today, but I thought maybe it's worth making an effort, and you'll either forget it or forgive me, or both if it doesn't work. And that is, you know, since the we're going towards happiness, that's the idea. So there's the alternative Four Noble Truths. There's the noble truth of happiness. There's a noble truth of the arising of happiness. There's a noble truth of the, not the cessation of happiness, but the noble truth of cessation that brings happiness. And then there's the Eightfold Path. So this is interesting how this goes. So happiness, I mean, that's pretty good. The noble truth, the noble reality of happiness. Buddhists are absolutely not diminishing the value of happiness and the importance of it. In fact, you'll see as I go along here that happiness, joy, gladness are an integral part of the path the Buddha taught. That this, you know, something that comes along in its own time. And it's kind of a happy path. At least it's kind of meant to be. You know, just once you get over the little hiccups along the way. And but, you know, that's at least the, you know, the doctrinal context for it. Whether it's that easy is a whole other topic, but certainly, you know, the it's presented in a context of happiness. So there is happiness, and what happiness is, I like the word well-being, because it's vague. And so it's easier for, you know, for the whole range of things that, you know, can fit under the topic of well-being. If it's happiness, you know, then it's a little bit, I find it a little bit oppressive. You know, I'm supposed to be happy, and, you know, then I have some kind of little idea of what happiness is supposed to look like, and I better be smiling and chipper, and, you know, and then everyone suffers because I'm trying too hard. And but the well-being, that's softer, it's more generous, it's more like, you know, I can kind of, you know, it's like, you know, that's like a big continent that I can get into rather than this narrow little idea of happiness. But anyway, there's the truth, the reality of happiness and well-being, and it's a possibility. And then here's where it's interesting, where the word that Oren mentioned for the second noble truth is samudaya, which literally means arising, sometimes taken to mean the cause or the condition or other things. But the literal meaning is arising, and the truth of the arising of happiness. There's something about it appearing, the beginning of it, the surfacing of it, that has, I think, some real value. That's a little bit different than looking to be happy. Like, I'm gonna be happy, and just boom, you know, that's gonna be it. I remember I think I was 19 or 20. I had a really good summer, and I came to, you know, I have this tendency for called the delusion of permanence. So I concluded, in a reasonable way, that I would never be depressed again. That fall, I was more depressed than I'd ever been. So the idea of, you know, happiness is a thing that stays, and, you know, that's maybe has problems. But the arising of it, that's interesting. And what brings it about? What causes it to arise? Maybe it's more interesting to know how it arises than it is how to keep it. Because if you try to keep it, you might freeze it. You might kind of make it brittle and hard because, you know, you're trying too hard to kind of fight reality, fight the changing nature of things. But if you have no other conditions that cause it to arise. And so in the teachings of the Buddha, at least, many things, you know, make us people happy, right? So, you know, some people are very happy if they win the California lottery. And that makes them happy. So whatever makes you happy, they say, right? But the statistics, the studies of people who win these big mega lotteries say that a year after winning them, most of the people are much more unhappy than they were before. So, you know, human beings don't always have a realistic idea of what real happiness is. Some of the happiness is not really well-founded. If someone gets happy because how much praise they get from other people, should that really be a secure, or reasonable source of happiness, praise? You can get a rush, but is that real happiness? But this, you know, the kind of happiness the Buddha was talking about, the happiness that comes from the path of practice, he describes as arising through two things. One thing that's present and one thing that's absent. One thing that's present and one thing that ceases. So the third noble truth has to do with the ceasing of something. Second noble truth of happiness is that happiness does arise. Notice that. Be interested in that thing. What is it? So there's two things the Buddha, he didn't say this explicitly, but if you look at, if you study how he describes the path to practice, these are the two things that he describes. One is you have to be aware. You have to be present. You have to have some space in attention for something like happiness to have a chance to arise. If we're preoccupied, caught up, reactive, which is all too easy to do, I mean, we all do that all the time, but it limits the capacities for happiness. Occasionally, reality is so strong that it interferes with our neurosis, and we get happy anyway. reality sometimes has that capacity. But for the Buddha, it was becoming aware, this mindfulness thing. So that was one thing, one of the conditions for the arising of happiness. So we have to require some capacity to be present and here for experience. And it's hard to have that capacity because there's a very strong tendency of the mind, reasonably so, to be concerned with getting things or adjusting things or fixing things or making ourselves safe or looking around the environment and looking at the threats or looking at where we're going to get the food for the next day or that day, and you know, all this kind of concern. We have this wonderful capacity to focus on things, to think about things. It's a useful tool. That's how, you know, life has gotten as far as us. But if that's all we do and we're preoccupied, then we don't make the space that's required for the happiness to arise. So awareness and mindfulness is what gives space. The second thing, in terms of the ceasing of something, the Buddha, in a variety of different actions or words, he talked about letting go, abandoning the hindrances, letting go of attachments, releasing our clinging. So this movement of opening the hands, you know, if the hand is in a fist, you're not going to benefit from the soft, sensitive part of the hand to touch something sweet and nice. So it requires releasing the fist for this wonderful, soft part of the hand to be effective. The wonderful, soft part of ourselves that can be the source and place for happiness. If we're bunched up inside as in a fist and contracted in the mind or in the heart, there's no possibility for that sensitivity, for that happiness to come. So those two things is what the Buddha talked about. He talked about letting go, and he talked about being aware and letting go. Exactly how this works, I can't tell you. But I find it remarkable because I know that it works. I've felt it and seen it. I've experienced it. And it's kind of remarkable because it's a kind of happiness that can arise for no good reason. And that's the most strange thing at all, right? You can kind of say there are conditions for it, perhaps, but usually happiness comes from a reason. Something happens. We win the lottery. We win a pie on Pi Day. You know, and the various things that can happen. So there's a thing that happens, or, you know, and so there's something in the world that shifts and changes that's pleasurable, that's meaningful, that's inspiring, that does something for us. And so that made me happy. But to sit quietly on a retreat and do nothing, except mind your own business, at least you're trying to, and just hear and let go, and nothing happened. You know, it's not like, you know, we don't give out prizes at the end of the day for the person who fidgeted the most. Look at me, I got the prize. You know, it's nothing, there's no, we don't do that here. So, you know, we're not giving you, you know, conventional reasons to be happy. But we sit here and we are mindful and present and we let go and settle. There might be a lot of letting go that's needed. And then something about the inner energy, something about the inner functioning, there can be a welling up of happiness and well-being that is not there because of external reasons. And that's a game changer for some people. Because some people, they only know about happiness that's acquired or gotten from the world out there. Then it makes sense to go out there and adjust the world all the time. But if you know there's another way, which is internal, and comes from awareness and letting go, deep awareness and letting go, then you have another way, and you can, it's portable, and you don't have to change the world so much. It's a little bit tiring to change the world, but to change yourself in the big picture actually makes a lot more sense. And then the fourth noble truth of happiness is the Noble Eightfold Path. I wasn't listening that carefully to Orange. I was listening carefully, but that had to be really precise what I'm about to say. I had the deep samadhi. I was listening. I was trying to listen, and I got the impression after a while when he talked about the Eightfold Path, he mostly said Eightfold Path. He didn't say the Noble Eightfold Path. And I thought that was interesting. Because there's two ways of understanding the Eightfold Path in the suttas. One is the Eightfold Path is like Oren spoke very nicely about, is a path that you cultivate towards freedom, to liberation. It's a path that leads you to the cessation of suffering. The other way it's talked about in the suttas, it's how a person lives once they've done that work. If a person has penetrated the Four Noble Truths, has learned to let go deeply, then the Eightfold Path becomes the Eightfold Path of the Noble Ones. And one of the meanings in Pali of this word, Pali of the Eightfold Path, Noble Eightfold Path, noble is not describing the path, the adjective for the path. It's describing the people who are noble. It's the Eightfold Path of the Noble Ones. And what happens is that with time, the Eightfold Path doesn't become a path. And even the word that's translated as, anyway, it's not become a path. It becomes who we are. We become the path. It becomes our nature, kind of, to live this way. And so when we attain this happiness that the Buddha talks about, the Eightfold Path is born in us as us. We will have the perspective, we will have the framework of seeing our life through the Four Noble Truths and see the usefulness of it, there will be right intention as just a natural byproduct. There will be ethics. There will be the samadhi factor in a certain way. Those things will be there kind of as a natural expression of this freedom and this happiness. And there's a way in which this path turns us inside out. And this idea of going into the fire and out in the water, this idea of going into ourselves, and in a sense, kind of separating ourselves from the world for a while, and doing this phenomenally deep work, that really the world needs some people to do this. Someone has to do it. We would be a very poor world if no one did it. And then we turn, and what happens, we go in and we get turned inside out, and the best qualities of who we are come back into the world, and it's in a nice way. So if you weren't happy with the Four Noble Truths of suffering, now you have the Four Noble Truths of happiness. Thank you. Do you want to say something, Warren? Yeah, so you're putting the mic on. I thought maybe you had... you had So we have a few minutes. If you want to ask Orin, Jill, and perhaps me, I just spoke a long time, but ask them some questions now. We did questions and, you know, this written question thing. And now if you'd like to do, you know, out loud, then it'd be nice to hear from you and hear your voice. And maybe you can say your name when you ask, and we'll see what we can do as a response.
So my name is Duana, and this question is actually for Jill. I was going to ask you at a one-on-one, but I didn't get a chance. So so you say that you are a teacher, independent teacher, who sort of relies on dana, right? So I'm wondering, like, what kind of frame of mind do you need to have to live like that? You know, I imagine it involves a lot of letting go and trusting and like that. So can you say something about it?
I'd say it was, has been, sorry. A long process to get to the point where this is my current expression of how I'm living my life. And I don't see it as an end point, so it's not that this is necessarily how it's going to be for the rest of my life, or something that anybody else should aspire to, but it's currently how my life is expressing itself. And it wasn't like I just woke up one day and said, okay, that's it, pack my suitcase, see you all later. There was, you could say, looking back with hindsight, a long period of training of actually gradually letting go, letting go, letting go. And then, as I was sharing in a meeting with someone earlier, when I first launched myself into this, it wasn't, you could say it wasn't fully by choice. There were circumstances that propelled me into it. And it felt like quite a risk, but I decided to give it a year and to frame it as research and development. Because that made it seem much less scary. It's like, okay, I'm just going to take a year out, write it off to research and development, and if it doesn't work, then, you know, research and development doesn't always work, but there was something very freeing about framing it as that, instead of thinking, whoa, I'm groundless and I don't know what's going to happen. It's like, oh, R&D. And so that's kind of a motto now, that my whole life is R&D. And it takes a lot of pressure off in terms of success and failure and right and wrong and good and bad and so on. So it's just, you know, for any of us, an invitation to play, to explore, to see where the edges are, and, you know, just push them a little bit if that feels useful, and see what are the results. Is that answering the question? For now. Okay, thank you. We can talk more later if you want to have more direct, maybe tomorrow.
Someone else?
Hi. This is for anyone who might care to respond. I've been interested in the quality of questions that have been arising for other people, because my experience is that I don't have any questions. This experience of being in a retreat has just felt like experience, and once again, I'm not sure what my question is, but just that idea of how is where is the bouncing from experience to that cognitive place of question, and I haven't made that jump yet to the question place. Do you know? I'm so in it. So I don't know if there are any comments, or should I be having questions? I don't know. That's a question. What about that question thing?
There's this odd thing that happens where some people come into a retreat, and a few days in, everything gets really quiet inside. Thinking's died down, and there's no worries and no stress, and they come into an interview and they say, I don't know what's wrong. I must be doing something wrong. Everything's quiet. I'm not stressing out about anything. And, I feel like I should be working harder. Something else should be happening. We get so used to struggling and suffering that when it ceases, we think that there must be something wrong. Sometimes we have questions and sometimes we don't.
I know. I'm used to thinking my way out of just about anything.
So I would just appreciate the quietness.
So, do I have to turn it on? Oh, there we go. Having this be my first retreat, I kind of went through the full range of emotions and awakenings and that kind of thing. And I'm very curious, in your perspectives, as having done this a lot more, how do, following retreats sort of differ, or how are they the same in terms of like what happens in your mind and with your learnings and that kind of thing?
It just gets better and better and better.
I'm a little bit reluctant to talk about my experience, because it's my experience, unique causes and conditioning. And so the main thing I can say is every retreat is different. And for me, that's what actually keeps it interesting and keeps me coming back for more, because every retreat feels like its own adventure. And I have no idea what's going to happen. And whenever I've thought, oh yeah, it's going to be like this, sadly wrong. So just to encourage you to keep exploring with an open mind and as few expectations or assumptions or preconceptions as possible, and then see for yourself and enjoy the adventure of it. It's my sense of it.
Yeah. I'll just add one thing, which is, in addition to what Jill said, what I've found in myself and many folks I know is that over the years of practice, the intense swings even out a lot. The struggle and the, you know, just the intensity of the roller coaster evens out more. It's not that things are predictable, you never know, but one learns how to practice more, and a lot of the rough edges in the heart start to soften.
So maybe time for one more.
My name is Sahar. Actually, this question for you, Gil. I'm wondering how first couple days of the retreat, I was so tired Okay, now, after I saw you, and then you told me, just watch, you might be attached to your suffering. So right away, it was like medicine. So I don't know what happened. Right away, I felt like relief. So would you explain to me, please, what that medicine?
So I'm not sure what to say. I'm happy for you. That's great. I think you're learning about the potential of your mind, the potential of your heart, and that one of the things that people learn through this practice is that the way in which our mind and our attachments are, glued together, but are stuck together, is not inherent. There's like little rubber bands holding our attachments to our mind. And if we realize that they're rubber bands and we can take them off, then the attachments might still be there, but they're no longer connected, and there's freedom, there's space, and there's relief, and we can breathe easier. And our thinking is not so much propelled by the attachments, the fears that we have. And then it's a lot less energy. A lot of the tiredness people have in our society is from minds that are attached. It takes a lot of energy to be attached and be preoccupied and think a lot. And it's tiring in and of itself, and it's tiring, it produces tiredness. But when that connection is no longer there, the rubber bands have broken, then the mind can operate much smoother and easier and happier. Does that seem a relevant answer for your question? Great. So I enjoyed sitting up here and seeing all of you, but boy, was it nice to stand there and look over here. I didn't realize what a good view you guys had. I thought that was pretty special. to see this. So that was new for me. I usually get stuck over in this side. So one of the ways that, or one of the important ways that IRC is set up, it's set up to have a culture or an approach of practice, way of being organized, that we hope is nourishing for everyone who comes here. We're here to drink the Dharma. We're here to be fed by our practice. We're here to be nourished by values that come out of the Dharma, or come out of our goodness. And that the idea is that if the values that support the practice are in harmony with the practice, then it makes it easier to discover the benefits of the practice or let it grow in us. And so some of the things that how we are set up here maybe is not completely obvious. We're such an unusual organization or thing. And so I kind of like to say a couple of minutes at the end of the retreat to just kind of express an appreciation of what we have here, and with the hope that in doing that, that you can somehow be inspired by it or fed by it or benefit from being in this kind of scene. I was involved with this since the very beginning, and I was part of a lot of conversations about the remodeling of this place. And pretty much anything that you see, just about anything, 98% of the things that you see and that you touch is there because someone's love, care, attention, as a volunteer, thought about it, researched it, considered it. And then there was money to buy that thing because people were generous. People offered donations to have this place be here so people like all of us could come here and practice here. You know, I don't know how many of you looked at realized how many magnets there are in this building. You know, all these doors that, you know, have magnets that hold them open, and the magnets on the door to the dining room, and you know, someone had to think magnets. We had someone involved who had a big thing about magnets. So that was where that generosity came from. But the doorknobs and lights and ceilings, and the amount of conversations we had about that ceiling. I mean, I don't know what you think about the ceiling, but maybe you didn't think about the ceiling. But that was a lot of conversations. Conversations about the floors, and I can go on and on. And so I walk around here, I know this history, and to me it's like magic that this happened. All this goodwill, all this stuff here. So the fuel or the underlying, what's meant to be kind of the underlying foundation of IRC is people's goodwill, people's generosity, people's gratitude, and people's goodness. And all these G's, like Gil. That's kind of meant to be really the fuel and what really drives it. And all those qualities are human qualities that come from human beings that have those and express them and live them. And so what we can offer here, offer retreats that are free, offer retreats that are all run by volunteers, a center that's all run by volunteers, it's an astounding thing. It's one of the bright lights in my life. And I hope that if this is meaningful for you or inspiring in some way that this kind of place exists, that it kind of feeds you and supports you and inspires you in the practice and in your own goodness, your own capacity to go into the world with some generosity, some goodwill, some something. And it's kind of my hope that what we have here is contagious, and that this will spread out across the lands, and in a variety of different ways, including more centers like this, because our waiting list is going to produce some ill will soon. Catherine, right? So come here, and so Catherine's going to make some announcements that what you need to know in terms of our closing and the process here. And you can sit here.
Got to get the right paper. Just want to thank everyone for their practice. It's been a joy, really. As we begin the gradual transition of returning to our daily lives, we want to do so in a mindful, unhurried manner. In general, you can trust the schedule. All will go smoothly. Those of you who've been here before know that you really can trust the schedule. So, I promise. Tomorrow, the morning will begin the same way, including Sangha service. Those who have morning work meditations after breakfast, please do them as usual. You know who you are. If you work after breakfast, show up. And in the morning, we'll have two cleaning periods, one for your room and one for the center. There will be time scheduled tomorrow to pack and clean your room. Trust the schedule. There will be time to clean your room and pack. But if you have time after breakfast and you want to get a jump on it, please feel free to start packing and cleaning your room then, if you're not working, of course. To clean your room, please follow the green instruction sheet in your room. It tells you what to do and where all the cleaning supplies are. Any questions so far with any of that? Well, you know, more will be revealed. This is just the general, just to kind of put it in your heads. In the morning, you'll see the schedule, or actually maybe tonight, tomorrow's schedule will go up. So it does work. Trust me. Any other questions? So, and the donation envelopes can be found on top of the Donna box between the office and meeting room one in the community hall. You can place a check, cash, or credit card info in them and direct your donation to the teachers, the center, or both. Instructions are on the envelopes, so check the envelope and it will guide you. Then you can drop them in the slot there in the box. Your donations are very much appreciated, as Gil was saying. And boarding passes. Yeah. I think it's better to put it on the envelope. It is better to put it on the envelope. I just got an affirmation of that. So just put the in credit card info. There's a space on the envelope for that. And I know, does anyone else need to print a boarding pass? I know, Maritza, you still do, and we can do that after this. Anybody else other than the people who've already done it? Okay. And so part two of this will be rides. So I know we have people going to the San Jose airport. Let's see. Nancy, you have a shuttle booked, you said, but okay. And then that leaves Maritza and David and Linda would need a ride to the San Jose airport. Is anyone going in that direction? By the San Jose airport to give three people, about two people that are going that way that would be willing to give rides. Read and tell me your name. Jean. Great. Two people. Can either of you have two people in their gear? Okay, Jean, how about with David and Linda, you want to raise your hands? So if you guys can connect tomorrow, that'd be great. And Reed, you can give a ride to, Yes. Maritza. Just two, David and Linda, yeah. And then Reed, you can hook up with Maritza. Want to raise your hand? Great. And you guys can coordinate that tomorrow. Wonderful. And Nancy, you've got your shuttle. Okay. And a couple other folks. I think, Hannah, you might need a ride to the East Bay. Okay. 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 Anyone going in that direction? Baruch? Okay. This is Hannah. Hannah Baruch. Great. And Oren needs a ride to Richmond. If anybody's going to Richmond. I know there is someone who lives in Richmond here besides me, but I'm not sure who it is. Yeah, I'm happy to give you a ride. I saw a hand over here, but... Okay. Tell me your name. Alan. Okay. Great. You guys okay? And one more, just one more item. It's about laundry and sheets and towels. Those of you who used sheets and towels that belong to IRC, please turn them in as early as possible tomorrow, even before the first sit, if that's possible, if you're that organized, it would be great. Also, please turn in your bath mat from the bathroom. Do not turn in your blanket or pillow protector. And you'll see laundry baskets on each floor. I guess that's it. Are there any more questions about any of that? Yes. I think so, yeah. Go ahead and bring your laundry over to the first floor baskets. Yes, Tara. Well, I think everything ends at 11:15. Oh, okay.
The formal ending is at 12:15, and then we have an informal snack time to hang out and get fortified for the trip. So then people usually stay until about 1:15, but at 12:15 you could. If you don't want to say hello to people, you just... So a couple of things I can add. One is the thing about trusting the schedule. I guess it's a good thing to say, but it's a little bit opaque what that means. I think one of the things it means is that... if you show up for everything on the schedule, then you can trust everything unfolds. So you have to show up. You have to be present to be happy. Susan. So work meditation, you said when the ones that are right after breakfast, when I normally go around 5. Yeah, no more. Just the ones after breakfast until 8:30. And then Hannah asked about the credit card. You know, all of you had to do deposit in order to get in. And so we took the credit card. And most people did do it through a credit card. And once you arrive here, that information basically vanishes. So we don't store that information. That's only reason we do that is we don't take the deposit, right? We just that's so people don't sign up frivolously, and they sign up just casually, and they don't really mean to come, or it doesn't occur to them to tell us they're not coming because it doesn't cost anything. So that's we have a little leverage with that. So but that information disappears. How do I do the lottery? It's a computer that does it, and there's a computer that's a system that's been set up, and it has various instructions of how to do it, one of the instructions is the computer saves the information for the people who didn't get in, and so like the first time you apply, you get one ticket for the lottery. And if you didn't get accepted and you didn't cancel in the wrong kind of way, it's all on the website, then next time you apply, you get two tickets. And so forth until the lottery gods favor you. So the last thing I'd like to say is that so the energy here this evening, this kind of gathering and talking and back and forth and more, a little bit more humor and all that, it's a different energy now than what we've had. And it can have a big impact on your nervous system and your whole being to have it. It's a little bit done by design because we want to, there's a transition we've started now about leaving. And so this is, giving care to how this transition is so by the time you leave, hopefully you'll be in a good space for that, and it's not too much of a shock to get on the freeway or something. And this is all part of this transition. However, now that it's more energized here, there's going to be more thoughts and all kinds of things. There are some people who then just write off the rest of the retreat, like it's over and so much for that. This is actually a very important part of the retreat. There's a long history in Buddhism that some of the most important insights or understandings or letting go that can happen don't happen as we go into practice, like into retreat, going deeper and deeper, but happen as we come out. And so we're kind of coming out in a sense as we get more thoughtful and stuff. And so it's actually a very important time to pay attention and to understand yourself, and you can maybe see yourself in a new way, and some of the old things that you do come back, but you see them as they come back as opposed to them just being there and nothing you can do. So we'll go through, so this is an important time. We're going to go back into silence now, and silence until, really silence until 11:15 when we have the closing circle, and we'll end tomorrow like how we started. And there's a rhythm of that's going to happen where we come back in silence, we sit, we work, we clean our rooms, we do center cleaning, and there's kind of a rhythm that gets us kind of going in a different way. And so just, again, this part of trusting the schedule is trusting how that unfolds. Marcia. Okay, So take good care of yourselves, and some of you will come back in half an hour, and we'll have a little sitting and maybe a few words at the end of the sitting. Thank you.